the media and democracy. Another good topic. Of course, I wouldn't put it on the agenda if I didn't think it was a good topic. Here's the problem. Democracy requires well-informed citizens. I think that's a kind of trivial point. You can't have a well-functioning democracy if people have lousy information about how the world works, about what the nature of the problems are, about the alternative solutions, with a reasoned debate around both the data, the information, and the costs and trade-offs among alternatives. You need an informed citizenry in order to have a vibrant democracy. That doesn't, of course, mean that you have to have 100% of the population being hyper-intellectuals engaged in as policy wonks. No, but you'd need a significant and substantial part of the population to be pretty well informed about the issues of the day. This requires a press that is not manipulated by the state. Clearly, a society in which the state dominates the media will have a very problematic status with respect to the idea of well-informed citizens. So we need a free press in that sense. The problem is, it's very expensive to produce and disseminate good quality information. I'm focusing here on the informational side of the media, not the entertainment side. There's also issues around entertainment, you know, arts, music, TV and dramas and so on. I'm going to be focusing on news and informational aspects. Broadly, journalism in its different forms in the media. It's expensive to produce and disseminate good quality information. And therefore, the organizations which are best able to disseminate information tend to be large and wealthy organizations. In a market-based media system, this means large, private, profit-driven corporations. And so the question is, can a media system dominated by large, profit-driven corporations, is it plausible that a media system dominated in that way can provide sufficient good quality information for citizens of a democracy? We need that kind of information. Is it likely that an information system, a media system that's dominated by large private profit-driven corporations, that that's a good infrastructure, a good system for providing good quality information for citizens? So let's look at how this works. Here's this, what could be called the standard view. There's a kind of little equation, if you will. The expression free press means free market press, which means free from government regulation. So the key threat to a free press in the standard view is censorship by the government. The free marketplace of ideas, that's a familiar phrase, I think, to most people, governs this perspective. In the free marketplace of ideas, only the best ideas, just like the best products, will survive the competition of the market. The assumption here is that the only threat to a free press is government control, not control by private wealthy elites. There's a view that treats ideas in the media very much like it views ordinary products. Perfect competition and consumer sovereignty will ensure an open arena for the dissemination of ideas and information. We need perfect competition, lots of different media producers. This will produce consumer sovereignty, the people will decide. Added to this is a particular view about journalism, that training and professionalism of journalists will ensure, quote, objectivity. And the only serious thing we have to worry about is government authority. Government is the enemy of the free press, not the guarantor of the free press. That's the standard view about how to think about the information system and the mass media. There are four problems with the standard view. First problem has to do with private corporate control over media content. And here's just the simple fact of the matter. This is not something that's in dispute. I often make very controversial claims in this class. This is not controversial. Private wealthy owners have the right and have the power to control the content of the news. In every television station in the United States, in every newspaper that's privately owned by a private profit-making corporation, the owners of those corporations have the right and the power to control the content of the news. Now, they could, in principle, use that right and power in such a way as to guarantee the free flow of ideas and the lack of any censoring or controlling of what appears on the media. You could imagine, in principle, the owner of a television network news system to say to its journalists, I empower you to completely run this operation according to your professional standards. And I will not interfere at all in any way with anything you say, even if you attack my corporation as being a scumbag corporation. You are free to run the news system the way you want as professional journalists. You know, if I'm a rich magnate, if I'm Ted Turner or Rupert Murdoch and control a media empire, I could empower my journalists in that way. It just never happened, but it could, in principle, happen. I have the power to do so. What actually happens is that the owners put severe constraints on what actually appears in the news. News content is broadly constrained by the interests of the owners of the news media. And that's true even for the lofty New York Times, which is often thought of as the kind of newspaper of record that's, and on the spectrum of objectivity of news presentation, it's probably more on the objective end of the spectrum. Nevertheless, for the New York Times, it's a private profit-driven corporation, and like all private profit-driven corporations, the news content is broadly constrained by the interests of the owners. The spectrum of legitimate opinion that appears in the news, in the American context, on both television news and in the newspapers, in the mass media part of the news system, the spectrum of legitimate opinion is from the moderate liberal position to the extreme right. It's not from the extreme left to the extreme right. The extreme right calls moderate liberals extreme leftists, but they're not. You know, Obama is smack in the middle of the political spectrum. He's not a radical left-winger, certainly not anything remotely like a socialist. And that's the range of legitimate political perspective. When you see these point-counterpoint discussions in the news where you have somebody sort of on the left and sort of on the right, it's typically somebody who's very conservative, borderline sort of Tea Party conservative, and somebody who's very much in the center. That's the spectrum. Journalists may be themselves relatively liberal. If you do surveys of journalists and ask them for their political perspectives, journalists do indeed tend to be relatively liberal, but they don't control what gets into the news. They're not autonomous actors. Reporters and editors are almost always severely constrained by the interests of the media owners and advertisers. So that's the first problem, private corporate control over the content of the media. Second problem, from competition to oligopoly. Oligopoly. I don't know if I've used that term. Just to increase your lexicon, the word monopoly, monopoly, means you have a market where there's a single producer of something. A monopoly is someone or some corporation that is the single producer. Oligopoly, like oligarch, oligopoly, means you have a market in which a few dominant players control the whole market. Often, monopolies and oligopolies don't behave all that differently, because if you only have a few giant producers in a market, they're able to coordinate and collaborate. Sometimes, quite explicitly, when they do, when you have more words to put down in your accumulating lexicon, when a group of oligopolists get together and really coordinate. It's called a cartel. A cartel is a set of agreements between powerful actors to coordinate all their actions and to function very much like a single actor. That's a cartel. An oligopoly doesn't have to be a cartel. They can still be competing, but they're competing from positions of enormous power rather than as simple individual players in a market. So the second problem is that a profit-driven, market-oriented newspaper and media system has an inherent tendency to lead to concentration. Huge newspaper chains in which most cities have only one newspaper, and this eliminates meaningful competition. There was a time when most cities of any size in Wisconsin had at least two newspapers. When I first moved to Madison, there were two vibrant and interesting newspapers in the city, and they took different perspectives. I subscribed to both of them, so I would get kind of the different takes on local issues. Now we only have one. That's true for most cities. And in many cities, their one newspaper is part of a chain in which the local content becomes extremely thin. There was a recent expose of the problem of local content in which there were no local reporters at all, and the local content of middle-sized cities' local newspapers were being culled from the web by a sort of journalist in the Philippines. That is, the newspaper chain hired hundreds of journalists in the Philippines to sit at their computer looking at the web and reporting on obituaries through, you know, there'd be death notices, and so they would call the web for the death notices and then send it back to the head office to be put into the local newspaper, rather than having any local reporters at all. The consequences of moving from competition to oligopoly is that there are huge barriers to entry, particularly huge barriers to entry for nonprofit-oriented media. This is particularly severe problem for TV news. Many people thought that the internet might solve this problem. And indeed, the internet does have extremely interesting possibilities of shaking up the media system. The problem is that most news sites on the internet are what are called aggregator sites. They don't have original professional journalists working for them, gathering news, doing investigative journalism, because they can't afford it. So what most news sites do is simply scour the web and aggregate from these big corporations news stories. They're useful digests of news being produced elsewhere, but they're not, so far, on the web. We do not have successful examples of primary journalism that produces high-quality, professionally produced investigative journalism, which is the heart of what newspapers ought to be doing. This is just a chart. This comes from the book. I won't belabor it here. That just shows the number of corporations that dominate the media industry over the last three decades, and just how dramatically the amount of competition has declined. Third problem with a purely market-based free market, free press equals free market view of the media. This centers on advertising and profit maximization. Profit-maximizing news media make money. That's the point, right? The reason you have a profit-maximizing firm is in order to make profits. How does the profit-maximizing media make profits? Almost entirely through advertising. The marketing objective, whoops. There we go. The marketing objective is to reach the audience that the advertisers want to communicate with. The marketing is to be viewed by people who are as attractive to advertisers as possible. What sorts of people are mostly attractive to advertisers? People with money, right? I mean, if you want to advertise on the national news, on national media, or in newspapers, you want to sell things, and the people who buy things are people who have resources. The result is that the media become oriented not to the general population of citizens, but to the general population of affluent consumers. News becomes geared to what's of interest to the affluent, not the average person. It's also designed to be inoffensive to advertisers. One thing you don't want to do if you're a news organization and your revenues are dependent upon advertisers is to continually insult your advertisers. News that is relevant to the public interest and the common good tends to be marginalized. Newspapers want to avoid offending people as much as possible. That's the third problem, the role of advertising and profit maximization as the basis for revenues. And finally, the fourth problem, which has become a more intense one, is cost-cutting versus quality as the basis for competition. Now, this is a complicated issue. It's not always true that cutting costs is the central basis by which firms compete with each other. It tends to be the case in saturated markets when you have few competitors. It tends to be the case that the bottom line preoccupation of investors in the corporations, not necessarily at all of the journalists who do the actual work, but of the people who are investing in the corporation, what they want to see is how big is the rate of profit relative to the amount of capital that they're putting in. And if they see the rate of profit declining, they shift their investments from one firm to another. What this investor-driven model of how you run a media system means is that short-run profit maximization becomes the central focus of the media CEO's concerns. And this puts huge pressures on news organizations to cut costs. What does that mean? Well, it's cheaper to have the media filled with news from syndicated sources rather than from one's own journalists. You know, investigative journalism is expensive. You have to pay for the journalists throughout the whole period that they're doing the investigation, at the end of which you get a story. That's a costly thing to do. It's much easier to fill your newspaper with reports that are generated by syndicated news services, like the Associated Press. So you have Associated Press and Reuters, two big news services that do have journalists, that do gather news. And most newspapers just pick stories off of the syndicated news rather than do their own journalism because it's cheaper. There's also an increased reliance over time. People who do journalists, how many of you are in journalism or communications arts? Must be some. Yeah, so you'll learn about this in the course of your studies. There's a lot of research on the character of news reporting. What are the nature of sources? Here's an example. The press conference and the press release. You have an elite organization, politicians or a corporation, and there's some problem that's occurring. So what do? They hold a press conference in which they can manage the interactions. Or they have a press release that's even more under their control. They release a set of official statements. Now, one way to do journalism is basically just to reprint the press releases of corporations. Another is to do the hard journalistic investigative work in which you see whether or not the press release is bullshit, or if you just take it at face value. Well, there's an increasing reliance on press releases and press conferences on what are called media events as sources of news. The result of all this has been a massive downsizing of journalistic staffs, closing of foreign offices. Major newspapers no longer have foreign offices in all the important capitals of the world, and a very significant decline in investigative journalism. Investigative journalism was the heart of what journalists used to do, not just humdrum daily reporting, but actually trying to delve below the surface of the phenomena. Now, all of these are consequences of a media system and a news-generating system that is overwhelmingly dominated by private, profit-maximizing corporations as the institutional structure within which news gets gathered and reported. And this is in tension with the standard view that private market-based media is the best way to ensure a free and autonomous press. I think because of time, I'm going to skip the detailed discussion of what's happened in recent years around radio. This is discussed in the text, and you should read it, because I would have otherwise put it in the lecture if we had a little more time. Let me just tell you what the punchline is. So here's the big picture idea behind the deregulation of the media, of the radio. Radio is a peculiar, and television, they're a peculiar kind of media because the airwaves are a kind of public commons, right? The air is here, we're all breathing it, nobody, you know, owns it. You can't simply have an unregulated radio system because then everybody would be fighting for the same frequencies and you'd have constant interference. See, there's a problem that has to be solved. You have to allocate the spectrum of the radio to people who want to use it. Otherwise, you'd have chaos. So everybody acknowledges that. There's a variety of ways you could do it. You can sell off bits of the spectrum so they become private property. Or they could always be public property, and you could lease it to various users, conditional upon them doing certain things. Both are equally legitimate. It's a common property. If you have common property, we can decide, yes, we'll let you use it, but you have to have 20% of your broadcasts be informational. And the information has to involve open public debate. You know, you could design the rules however you wanted to because it is a common property. In the United States, we sold off the spectrum without very much control. But until 1996, there was still quite a lot of regulation around the nature of the property rights that people could have. And in particular, there was severe regulation, very strong regulations, uncharacteristic in some ways for the United States, that blocked corporations from owning large empires of radio stations across the country. Before 1996, a single firm could only own one radio station in a given market, and relatively few radio stations across markets. Now that meant that before 1996, there was a vast array of small local radio stations all across the country. And some of them were really quirky and individualistic and had all sorts of local flavor. They were deeply embedded in their local worlds. Since 1996, with the Telecommunications Act during the Clinton administration, almost all regulations on ownership have been removed, and the result is that Clear Channel Radio now owns 1,200 stations nationwide. Almost 30% of the market in radio stations is controlled by a single corporation. The irony here is that there's almost no economies of scale in a radio. It's not more efficient to own 50 than to own one in terms of the cost of running the station. There's almost no economies of scale. What there are huge economies in attracting advertisers. So if you own 50, you can get a much better deal with advertisers. You're much more attractive to have a contract with advertisers because the advertiser suddenly gets to advertise in 50 stations. What consolidation has done, in other words, has given even more leverage to advertising as the driving force in organizing radio. Okay, last theme, alternatives. We've got a dismal story here, in my judgment. We have a media system that is not serving democracy well. Remember, the purpose of this part of the course is the nature of democracy. The question then here is, Do we have a media system that's the right kind of media system for a vibrant democratic world? I think we don't. So what can we do? So here's the bottom line idea. This is what grounds the idea for alternatives. A vibrant, high-quality free press in the public interest is a public good, not just a private good. This is of our collective public concern. As we know, in general, capitalist markets do a poor job in providing public goods. That's not what they're designed to do. Capitalist markets are designed to maximize profits of firms. For some kinds of economic activities, that's just fine. For others, it results in the under-provision of public goods. And if a high-quality media is a public good, something other than capitalist markets has to be the basis by which it is produced. Public goods need some kind of systematic public support. There are three basic kinds of broadcast media. So this is just a description of the landscape. These are the possibilities. You can have commercial media. That's the predominant one we have. The media system in the United States is dominated by private commercial firms. Other places in the world have a much stronger public non-commercial sector paid to a significant extent through taxes. In the United Kingdom, for example, when you purchase a television, you also have to purchase a license to use the television, just like you have a license to drive a car. The purpose of licensing cars, in addition to licensing the competence of the driver, that's a driver's license, but having a registration fee for the cars, is that those registration fees help to fund the whole system of support for automobile driving. Traffic, policemen, roads, and so on. That's why we also have gas taxes. Well, the license fee to have a TV in Britain pays for the BBC. For those of you who like BBC shows, you know, Masterpiece Theater, other things on PBS, and various other kinds of things that the BBC does, that's all paid for by public funds in Britain. And that's on the grounds that it's a public good. Public broadcasting in the United States, in contrast, is heavily dependent on donations. Less than 15% of the revenues of public broadcasting in the U.S. comes from taxes. Most of it comes from donations of one sort or another. The problem really is this third category, the state-owned media, that's like the BBC. They have direct access to taxes. I don't think that a state-owned media system is the way to solve the problem of a vibrant media for democracy. I think what's really needed is nonprofit, non-commercial community broadcasting in different forms. But there you have the basic classic problem of the free rider problem. How do you get revenues for such forms? Lots of people like to listen to public radio, even if you don't pay for it. Only about 10% of people who listen to Wisconsin public radio donate to it. And that's understandable. You know, they're all being free riders on other people paying, but we all know free riding is a tempting thing to do. So what can we do about it in the last few minutes? What would it take? I think there are four key elements that are needed for a democratic media system. And just briefly, first, you just need to prohibit media empires and conglomerates. They should just be broken up on the grounds of public interest, that media empires and conglomerates are bad for democracy, and that's a justification for breaking them up. There used to be such regulations. They should be reinstated. The public, non-commercial, non-profit media sector should be the dominant sector in broadcasting around news. I'm particularly focusing on information stuff. I think the public, non-commercial, non-profit media sector needs to be the dominant, the core of the way media works. And then the capitalist free market sector adapts to that core as opposed to the other way around. This should be in a context where very diverse forms of ownership should be underwritten, encouraged. Employee cooperatives, community stations, university stations, nonprofit corporations, all of these need subsidies. For newspapers, I think the ideal form would be cooperatives of journalists, where the journalists actually own and run the newspapers, under conditions of public subsidy of one sort or another. A newspaper system in which it was the journalists who controlled the newspapers would produce a vastly higher and more interesting quality of journalism than one in which profit-maximizing corporations owned them. But this can only happen if we can figure out a way of having public subsidies for the information media, public subsidies without state control. That's what we have to figure out. How public subsidies with state control has too many risks of censorship and domination by political elites. That's unquestionably a danger. What we need are to figure out ways of having public subsidies without state control. And here's two elements of what that would involve, public subsidies without state control. The first is to return the airwaves to public control and treat them as a public resource. So for broadcast media, this whole privatization of the airwaves should be just reversed. That is might take time. You'd have to buy out the property rights. I think it's imperative to regain control over the commons, the collective resource of the airwaves, and then to impose various kinds of conditions, and to use that property rights in the airwaves as a way of directly subsidizing non-commercial, community-based uses of the airwaves. But the other thing, which I'll just give you the initial description of now, it's discussed in the book, and I'll probably spend a few minutes at the beginning of the next lecture, is to have what are called targeted tax credits, not tax deductions, for nonprofit media support. Basically, this means, for example, here's a simple, really simple idea. Every taxpayer gets a $200 tax credit. So you don't get a bigger tax credit if you're rich and poor. Everybody gets a $200 tax credit, which they can allocate to newspapers and other informational media. Which means that those media would not have to rely on advertisers for their resources. So the idea of a newspaper that's a cooperative of journalists, they form a co-op, and then they get their readers to allocate their $200 non-refundable tax credits to their cooperative in order to produce the newspaper, would provide a huge set of public money going towards newspaper on an egalitarian citizen basis, not on the basis of how wealthy you are, and would underwrite a massive non-commercial, non-market, truly free press for the production of information for a vibrant democracy. See you next week.